Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and this episode is the second part of our look at the canids with Xiaoming Wang of the Natural History Museum in LA. If you remember from the first episode, we discussed what a canid is and how it differs from a canine. So just to recap, Canidae is the family and Caninae is a subfamily. So all canines are canids, but not all canids are canines. There were two other subfamilies, which are now extinct, and we rejoin the episode taking a look at these. As always, with the supplementary images for this episode on paleocast.com, where you can see some fantastic reconstructions of these extinct subfamilies and leave comments. So please let us know what you've thought of this episode. So the only canids left alive now are the canines, the dogs. So the Hesperocyoninae and Borophaginae, I wrote them down, they are all extinct now.
That's true, yes.
So why did they go extinct but not the canines?
Well, the short answer to your question is we don't know. Extinction is a particularly hard question to keep track of. I mean, you can think about the long argument about the extinctions of the Ice Age megafauna, which is still heatedly debated by all sorts of scientists. The long answer for the extinctions of the dog family is that in general, those group of animals who become more specialized, particularly specialized toward a larger body size, in other words, they become predators of a larger prey, and they also tend to specialize more exclusively in the carnivorous diet. And those animals tend to be a lot more prone to extinction. Think about it this way. Basically, these carnivores, when they specialize, they become larger body sized and then specialize on meat eating only. That's when they tend to specialize on a smaller number of species. Basically, they are narrowing down their prey species very much. And if you are basically living off a single or two or three species of your choice, if those prey became extinct or for some reason reduced in numbers, then you're in trouble. So, evolutionarily, you see these stories plays out again and again, that animals, carnivores become progressively larger and larger. At a certain point, they become too large and they became extinct. And then smaller carnivores take over the open niche. And then they get into the larger categories. And then they become extinct again. So the reason that I think the Hesperocyonin and also the Borophagin eventually became completely extinct was that gradually all of their small generalized ancestral lineages has all become larger and bigger and then more predatory. And they have no special, and there is no generalist like small fox-like animal. And therefore, when the large pure predator became extinct, there is nothing to replenish that niche anymore. That's not the case for the living subfamilies of canines. You can see that you have the highly predatory or highly specialized animals like the wolves and like the hunting dogs, but you also have foxes. So as a group, the modern canids, I think, will do fine. Maybe the wolf will become extinct sooner or later, or the hunting dog will become extinct. But there are these all of these smaller fox-like animals that they can take over the opportunity when the opportunity presents itself. So in that sense, I think the living subfamilies, the canines, are more resilient group because somehow they always manage to preserve a few species or a few lineages within the subfamily that are small and generalized. They are not terribly specialized. And those animals always have a far better track record of longevity. So evolutionarily, they have a longer stay in the record.
And what of the specialization of actual dogs? Is it Canis domesticus that we have? Could they be a threat to other canines in terms of filling their niches if left?
Are you talking about the domestic dog itself? Or okay, the domestic dog, if you are referring to the specialization of or the kind of a highly sort of a bizarre shapes or features that human has selected for, and those are really not, and these are fall in the category of artificial selections, where these features are appealing to our own sense of aesthetics or whatever other utilities that human like to fancy. And these features have no natural utility. Basically, if you leave some of these highly specialized dogs alone in the nature, they have no chance of survival. Let's say the bulldogs or any of the puppy little dogs that the breeds, if you leave it alone in the natural world, they probably will become extinct by themselves. So yes, in that sense, these dogs are highly dependent on the human largesse so that they can survive. As long as we have enough dog food to feed them, I guess they're doing fine. So this is a completely different phenomena that has nothing to do with natural selection or evolutionary the usual evolutionary principle that govern this. In other words, the feature that we selected for really have no natural utilities or adaptive value to themselves. It's entirely to the about our human fancies and our likeness of it.
When do we start to see domestication of dogs?
The fossil record is still very, very controversial. The fossil record, in my estimate, the best fossil record from the Mesolithic sites in Israel, where you have a human and a domestic god associated, and they are buried together. That dates back about 12 to 13,000 years ago. And then if you go back, there are progressively older records that has been claimed to be domestic dogs, but morphologically, they progressively become more blended with their ancestral wolf populations. In other words, it's getting harder and harder to identify based on the shape of the bones, whether or not these are true dogs or not. Now that the new fossil DNA or the ancient DNA techniques can help us a little bit better. And that's why the molecular biologists these days actually claim to track down the ancient dogs up to as old as 30,000 years ago, or even earlier than that. I think at a certain point, it's become arbitrary whether you call a dog or a wolf, because at the beginning of the domestication process, one might assume that these early progenitors of dogs are very wolf-like, and therefore their fossil record may not be readily identifiable as such, because they just look like a wolf. Yeah.
Do we have problems in identifying social behavior in canines in the fossil record in general?
Oh, very much. Social behavior as a class of information usually dies when the animal dies. Basically, as soon as an animal dies, he or she will not move anymore, and therefore the behavior is gone. Only in very, very rare cases, I can think of, like, for example, the footprints, fossil record of footprints, they do record some of the behavior, but those are very rare. So on the whole, yes, the behavior are only available to us in a very indirect way. So we can, for example, look at the brain, for example, of the dogs. There are actually paleontologists from the Field Museum of Natural History. He looked at the brains of by brain, I mean the actual shape of the brain, not actual brain itself. The brain itself, it doesn't really preserve in the fossils. The brain shape give us a little hint about how complex the brain might be, or how large the brain might be. That give you a little hint, but that's nowhere nearly enough to really have a solid foundation of understanding of these extinct animals' behavior. So yeah, in general, we have a hard time to really grasp just exactly how these animals behave. And oftentimes our understanding is in a very, very indirect or tangential way. By looking at, for example, looking at the canine size, in this case, I refer to the longest tooth in the mouth, the one that the wolf bear the mouse, and you will see the two longest sort of fang-like tooth are the canine. The size of the canine and the size of the male and then versus the females tend to give you some hint about the family structures of the carnivores. So by that, you can deduce a little bit whether these animals are more group-oriented or whether they tend to like to live alone by themselves, and that kind of information. But it's very, very hard to come by.
Yeah, it sounds like there's still a few questions left to be answered with that. Is there much still left unknown about canid evolution?
Yes, there is. Canid as a group of carnivores, when I said a canid has a fantastic record in the North America museum collections. Nonetheless, canid still is part of the larger group of carnivora. What that means is that carnivores as a group, because they are sitting on the top of the food chains or the food pyramids, by nature, they are rare. So for every carnivore, there are 10, 15, or 20 herbivores. And then that ratio actually are also reflected in the fossil collection in the museums. In other words, it's just very hard to find a fossil carnivore. So our understanding of the carnivore evolution through the fossil record are still poor compared to their herbivorous counterpart. So that's the reason that there's always a large potential for new discoveries of fossil carnivores anywhere, even where the fossil record are already fairly good in North America. The room for new discoveries are still there, and especially in continents where the paleontology are relatively new, like say in Asia, and in Africa, and also in South America. So yes, there are tremendous new discoveries, and of course there are also new techniques to come along. For example, tomorrow I'm heading to the Natural Trap Cave in Wyoming. This is a fossil cave site in the Ice Age megafauna. That the primary objective was to obtain ancient DNAs from the cave materials. So the ancient DNA has just got started. So there is a huge potential of new discoveries of ancient DNAs. So yes, the new techniques of how to look at it, for example, the scanning using the CT scans to reveal fossils in novel ways, leave another big areas of new discovery. So yes, science will never stop, and there is always a lot of exciting discoveries laying ahead.
Well, Xiaoming, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, David. It's my pleasure.
Well, I hope you've all enjoyed hearing about the early evolution of man's best friend. But similar to Xiaoming himself, I'm a cat fan, so I kind of feel as if we need an interview on the Felidae in the future. But for now, though, Laura and I have both been working on some pretty exciting scripts, and so we'll have these to look forward to in the next couple of weeks. Our next episode, however, will be on our second year anniversary, so we're going to have another year's review and catch up on where all the PaleoCast team members are up to in their studies and what we've got lined ahead of us. Most of us will actually be headed to the 4th International Paleontological Congress, or IPC4 for short, in Mendoza, Argentina at the end of September. So this is a paleontology world conference, effectively, and it's the biggest event in the field and only ever happens once every 4 years, so it really isn't one to miss. Unfortunately, though, I might have to miss it due to being called off to the oil rigs. Fingers crossed, though, because I'd love to share an entire week of paleontology with you all. As always, please leave a comment, share, like, and subscribe. It really helps to grow the show. And make sure you tune in on the 1st of September for our second year anniversary.
Paleo. Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
Paleontology, especially the sort of a traditional paleontology, by that I mean the paleontologists who still go out to the field and then collect the fossils and coming home and studying them. I happen to belong to that genre of paleontologists. Discovery is still very exciting, and therefore every summer I go out to collect fossils, and this year is no exception. As I had just mentioned, that I will go to the Natural Tribe Cave in Wyoming, and I'm going to Inner Mongolia, and in the recent years I have been going back to the Tibetan Plateau every year to look for fossils and finding new discoveries. One of the spectacular discoveries that I personally made was a complete skull of a woolly rhinoceros from the Tibetan Plateau. So this particular rhino is the oldest and the most primitive rhino in the world. Woolly rhino, that is, not a rhino. There are other rhinos that are older. And this happened to be the ancestor to the woolly rhinos that are thriving in the Ice Age. So the discovery that we made in Tibetan Plateau led us to formulate a new idea. This is what we called out of Tibet idea, that Tibet might be a cradle of the Ice Age megafauna. In other words, Tibet, because of its high elevation and an associated cold environment, animals that living in high Tibet actually was able to adapt themselves to the harsh and cold environment in Tibet before the Ice Age has came along. Ice Age came about 2.6 million years ago, but these Tibetan animals actually lived in there long before that, so that they actually were what we call pre-adapted to the cold environment. When the Ice Age came along later, these Tibetan animals found themselves to be actually happier and to spread out to the rest of the world. So that's the basic ideas of out of Tibet hypothesis that we are working on. And that's a very exciting discovery that we have made in the past few years.
Do you find any other of the Ice Age faunas in Tibet before the Ice Age as well?
Yes, we are beginning to see other megafauna elements that are also originated in Tibet. One of them, probably most people are not very well familiar with, is the Asiatic or Tibetan blue sheep. This is a sheep-sized animal, or a goat. Actually, it's more related to the goats. It's an animal that actually are part of the Ice Age megafauna. So the blue sheep, as it turns out, also originated in Tibet. And recently, we have discovered a ancestor of snow leopard. Snow leopard in the modern time is confined to the Tibetan plateau. We were able to trace its ancestry by several million years ago in the high plateau. So once again, Tibet seemed to have been the home or the ancestral origin of these kind of animals, particularly animals that may be thriving in cold environment. For example, the North America and the European bison may also have their origin in the Tibetan plateau. I don't have a fossil record for it. However, if you look at the bisons, they are their closest relative is actually the Tibetan yak. The Tibetan yak, as you might know, that is very well adapted to the cold high plateau by having these long, long hairs trailing down from their body, all over the body. So bison actually is what we call the sister group of the yak. So it may very well have a ancestral start in Tibet. Another possible example is the North American bighorn sheep. And the bighorn sheep is also a mounting adapted animal, and it's also love cold environment. And as it turns out, the ancestral lineage of the sheep lineage actually started in and around the Tibetan plateau areas, such as the modern Marco Polo sheep in the Altai region, and also in northern Tibetan plateau. So these are examples that seem to suggest that the cold environment is actually a very important place where a lot of the animals actually have learned their special endurance in those places, and then they actually spread to the Arctic regions. One of the recent papers that we published in the proceeding of the Royal Society was linking a Tibetan fox, an ancestral Tibetan fox, to the Arctic fox, or the modern Arctic fox. So once again, cold environment and high elevation seem to be coupled together in the past history, and that actually played a very important role in the evolution of some of these animals.
Can you prove that the megafauna came out of Tibet and spread to the poles rather than the other way around? Is it not a case that you might just have the correct kind of rocks in Tibet from the correct kind of age, and you've got people looking for them, whereas you might have older rocks that are still underground up in the at the poles, where we've not yet discovered these older relatives to the megafauna?
That is a very good question. In fact, that is a very fair question too. Our knowledge about the Arctic fauna is very poor. What I'm talking about is a fossil record of the Arctic, mostly because they are either under ice cover or they have been altered by the ice sheet during the ice age, such that there's very few, if any, that places that actually preserve these older records. So yes, until we have a comparable age relationship that we can compare apple to apple, so to speak, about the same age of faunas from the Arctic and the Tibet. The question remains open whether or not Arctic actually is the place that actually originated, these megafauna actually originated. However, having said that, there are actually geological records that shows during the Pliocene, this is the time from about 3 to 5 million years, 2 to 5 million years of age. During that time, when we have these ancestral Tibetan megafauna population that we find in the record, the Arctic climate was actually much warmer. As warm as 8 degrees centigrade warmer than it is today. So it seemed to show that the Arctic was not that cold in those days. In contrast to a high Tibet, even if you assume that the global climate was much warmer in the past, simple physics, if you are standing 5,000 feet or 5,000 meter above the sea level, which is the average elevation of the Tibetan plateau, you are basically approximately 30 degrees colder than it is at the sea level in the same altitude. So that just shows you how dramatically colder it is in Tibet. Combined with the evidence that the Arctic environment during that time was actually much warmer. So I think this, at least given the current knowledge, the evidence seemed to favor the Tibet to Arctic directions of dispersal rather than the reverse.
So this all came around by doing field work and actually getting out there looking for new fossils. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's still more to be... Well, you're going to find more in the Tibetan Plateau. And would you recommend that in general paleontologists should be looking out in the field more?
Yes, not only doing the field work is one of the pleasures of this profession, but also it's really to me the discovery always ranks high in terms of the overall satisfaction as a paleontologist. So yes, I would encourage everyone to continue to look for fossils and then make new discoveries. Some people might think that the fossil has been we have been searching for the badland, let's say in North America, for the last 100 and 150 years. But even in those areas where it's been searched for the last 150 years, you still find new stuff from there. It's a simple fact of the life that the fossil discoveries are, on the whole, a very slow process. I can easily see that we can still have another 100 years, 200 years of discovery ahead of us. The rate of new discovery are slowing down. That much is true, because if you are a pioneer paleontologist and you walk into the North American Midwest or the Western U.S. or where you are the first one to collect fossils, you by and large, every fossil you pick up are something new to science. And that is certainly gone. So nowadays, every fossil you pick up, our chances are they have been already known to science. But nonetheless, there are still a lot of room for new discoveries. And that, I think, is really exciting.
Well, do you think that we should all be looking in different places? The explosion of China in the paleontological world, do you think Tibet will be the next? Maybe Siberia, Russia?
Absolutely. I think it's human nature that we try to go to ever more exotic places and to the end of the world, so to speak. We are curious beings, and so we want to go to places where nobody else has been to, and Tibetan plateau, and for that matter, the Arctic regions probably hold more promises, because it's just that harder to get in, both physically and also politically. Basically, you need to have permits, and you need to arrange logistics, and of course, also financially is a higher hurdle to overcome to go to these more exotic places. So yes, these I think Tibetan plateau probably is going to be the next frontier of discovery in there. Yes, it's probably not going to be nearly as explosive as some of the other Chinese discoveries in recent years, because most of the Chinese discoveries, let's say the feathered dinosaurs or the marine reptiles, those discoveries are mostly made in areas where there is a long tradition of what we call the dragon bone hunting, basically farmers digging in the hills to mine the fossils, and then they sell the fossils to other people. So when you have a whole army of farmers digging in their backyard or in their close by mountains and hills, the rate of discoveries is probably hundreds of times faster than it would be for the professional paleontologist. You have a half a dozen people walking around in a single field season in the small areas. So and that still is the case in Tibetan plateau. So there is no large armies of farmers to prowling the ground to dig for fossils. So the rate of discovery is going to be still fairly slow, but that's okay. I'm fine with that. My personal opinion is that there's a lot of negative effect of these dragon bone hunting. In other words, the lots of contextual information gets lost when you have the farmers dig fossils for you.